this week on Viewpoints.
If it amuses you to think that someone else, including your great-great-great-great-grandmother or grandfather, wrote the plays, that I suppose there's nothing all that harmful about it.
Did someone else write Shakespeare? Then...
business schools, unfortunately, are teaching people not to be ethical. In other words, business schools that force the whole concept of winning is and competition is about the only thing that you need to focus on.
What about ethics? We'll hear how a disregard for values led to the Enron debacle. I'm Sandy Houseman.
And I'm Christopher Michael. These stories in depth this week on your public affairs magazine, Viewpoints.
And now for Milestones in Medicine, brought to you by Merck & Company, a global research-driven pharmaceutical company and the publisher of Your Health Now magazine. Today, having your blood pressure measured is a routine part of a physician's visit. However, this was not always the case. It was not until the late 1800s that scientists invented the sphygmomanometer, the first accurate and practical instrument for measuring blood pressure. High blood pressure can increase your risk of suffering a stroke, heart attack, or kidney failure. Talk to your doctor about your blood pressure and ways to keep it in the normal range, such as reducing your sodium intake. Today's Milestone in Medicine is powered by Your Health Now, a new free health magazine from Merck. Learn more about blood pressure and register for a free subscription for Your Health Now magazine at yourhealthnow.com. Merck, where patients come first.
We all know his name. Even if it was only because we were forced to, we've all studied his writing. The words and characters of William Shakespeare are so famous and so true to human nature, they've become a part of our culture. All the world's a stage and all the men and women merely players. But what if this great figure, perhaps the greatest to ever hold a pen in his hand, and his great works, from Hamlet to King Lear to the sonnets, were written by someone else?
The problem with William Shakespeare's authorship is that there is no documented evidence that he was a writer. There's no record of an education, no record that he had a patron. And, we know this person had to have read more than 220 books in four languages to write the plays. There's never been a record of a book that he read or used or owned. No one ever said he was a writer. He's never paid as a writer. No manuscripts have ever been found, nothing in his handwriting but six signatures.
That's Robin P. Williams, member of the Shakespearean Authorship Trust in London. She says we know Shakespeare was an actor and a shareholder at the Globe Theater, but the evidence for him as a writer is suspect. In her new book, Sweet Swan of Avon, Williams suggests that it might be possible the man who wrote Shakespeare's poems and plays wasn't a man at all.
Sydney, what made me start to look at her as a possible candidate was she developed the most important literary circle in English history. And I'm not making that up. Her scholars all agree that for two decades she led this very important literary circle. And in this circle, in her life, her mission in life was to create great works in the English language.
Mary Sidney was a very educated woman from a very noble family, which William says would have been disgraced if Mary was involved in the vulgar theater. This is where Shakespeare would have come in to put his name on her plays. William says that Sidney had the intellectual heft to write such a body of work, and she also would have had personal access to the kinds of royalty and aristocracy that are dramatized in the plays. But it was the sonnets that perked William's curiosity about authorship.
The sonnets are the biggest question in the life of William Shakespeare, because in this sonnet collection, 154 sonnets, most of them are written to a man, which was a first clue, which made me think, my gosh, if there's been this question for 200 years about who wrote these works, and the sonnets are written to a man, why has no one ever considered that it's possible that a woman had written these?
Stephen Greenblatt is a professor of English at Harvard University and author of the book Will in the World, How Shakespeare Became Shakespeare. He says the Mary Sidney theory is fun to think about, but probably wrong.
Shakespeare was not the only talented person of his age. There are many talented people, including Mary Sidney, who was an impressive writer. I think if you actually read Mary Sidney's work, most people would have their doubts that this person is likely also to be the author of King Lear, or for that matter, Love's Labour's Lost. But if it amuses you to think that someone else, including your great-great-great-great-grandmother or grandfather, wrote the plays, that I suppose there's nothing all that harmful about it, any more than there is about any number of other speculations or fantasies that people have. But they're very, very far from what comes down to us in the archival record.
Sidney, of course, is not the first candidate to be considered the secret author of Shakespeare's work. Everyone from Francis Bacon to Queen Elizabeth I to the Earl of Oxford has been in contention. Greenblatt says this kind of speculation is basically a waste of time.
A group of his friends, fellow actors, wrote extravagant praises of Shakespeare for the First Folio. Now, I understand very well that the people who believe that someone else wrote the plays argue that none of these things are to be believed in, that this is all an elaborate front, just as a conspiracy. Frankly, I find it kind of boring, but I know everyone doesn't find it boring. They find it fascinating. I find the plays tremendously interesting and exciting, and I love thinking about them and talking about them. I find the generating of speculations as to alternative authorship at first mildly interesting, and then just in the way that scandals are interesting, but then actually very, very quickly quite tedious, personally. Tedious because nothing ever comes of it. There's never enough counter-evidence to go on that would be interesting.
Yet scholars and Shakespeare buffs continue to wonder how this one man produced such an incredible, all-encompassing body of work. Plays that are timeless, humorous, historical, romantic, and everything in between. Scott Howard, professor in the Department of English at the University of Denver, says nobody questioned Shakespeare's authorship while he was alive. Howard says today we like to think of one person being behind a great work of art. But playwriting in Shakespeare's time was very collaborative.
Marlowe and Shakespeare were both playwrights who worked very closely with the actors and the producers. Composition and the transmission of the plays from, you know, the manuscript material to the prompt copies that would be used on the stage that the actors would use themselves, that transmission from manuscript to prompt copy to what we might call today a play text, a working copy of the play that would then be used for the direction of the performance. That transmission was a very fluid, dynamic process. And at every step along the way in that process of transmission, the material would be changed. And actors themselves had a tremendous amount of license and responsibility and freedom to work with the manuscript material and to adapt it.
Howard says barely any of Shakespeare's original manuscripts are left for us to look at. But we do have the writing of other writers who were either jealous of or in awe of what the bard was accomplishing. One of them was a romantic novelist named Robert Greene.
An upstart crow that with his tiger's heart wrapped in a player's hide supposes he is as well able to bombast out a blank verse as the best of you, and is, in his own conceit, the only shake scene in a country. So that's Robert Greene reflecting upon Shakespeare's rising sense of self-importance as a writer.
Ben Jonson was another great writer who felt the need to tip his cap to Shakespeare.
He was not of an age, but for all time. Nature herself was proud of his designs and joyed to wear the dressing of his lines, which were so richly spun and woven so fit, as since she will vouchsafe no other wit. All these fantastic ideas about Shakespeare's eternal greatness and this universal genius that he has, and how nature actually envied his work because his creations of character were so lifelike that they're more natural to us than human nature itself. That's where Harold Bloom's thesis about Shakespeare inventing the human digs into this long-standing tradition of how great Shakespeare's genius was.
The question then becomes, how did this small-town boy who didn't even have a university education become such a genius of endless range and imagination? Conspiracy theorists would argue that the man simply wasn't qualified to write all those plays. Well, Greenblatt says that's a faulty presumption.
This is a writer of stupendous power and accomplishment, so everyone wants to claim some piece of it. And the fantasy game is fueled by certain feelings, in the case of Shakespeare, by an anxiety that he didn't go to university, as if going to the university were the key to literary genius as a dramatist, which is an absurd idea. Or he didn't come from the right social class, as if being an aristocrat were the key to writing Hamlet or King Lear. But I understand that these feelings keep circulating, and if they make the lineal descendants of the Earl of Oxford or whatever feel good about themselves, then it seems to me that there are more wicked ways of spending your time.
He adds that just because Shakespeare's personal history doesn't bear much similarity to the subject matter of his plays doesn't necessarily mean anything.
I think he was, among other things, a fantastic fly on the wall. There's a very funny record of Shakespeare being paid, along with other members of his company, to, in effect, possibly in the literal sense of helping to wait on tables, but actually just being attendant on a foreign delegation to the court. They hired Shakespeare and his fellow actors, who were no doubt attractive and well-behaved people, gave them some clothing and gave them some money to swell the ranks of the servants at court. And it's amusing to me to think of that moment, because they hired to stand around and watch the aristocrats at their lives, probably the most observant human being in England.
Even if the evidence against Shakespeare's authorship isn't very strong, Greenblatt says there is still a mystery to be solved.
It's not the mystery of how somebody else wrote these things. It's the mystery of human creativity at this level. How anyone could have achieved these remarkable works is a fantastic human mystery that needs to be addressed. And it needs to be addressed if you're fascinated with Shakespeare, as it would need to be addressed if you're fascinated by Mozart or Beethoven or the painter Peter Bruegel. It's not a question of someone else doing it. It's the wonder and mystery of human accomplishment at this level.
It's probably safe to say people will go on questioning the legacy of the greatest playwright of all time. Along with the beauty of the language and the timelessness of the stories, it's another reason for the legend to continue, and for the works of Shakespeare to be part of our collective consciousness. But if you're going to seriously propose that it's someone else's name we should be celebrating, as Shakespeare would say, let there be gall enough in thy ink. Sweet Swan of Avon, Did a Woman Write Shakespeare by Robin P. Williams, and Will in the World by Stephen Greenblatt are available in bookstores and online. I'm Christopher Michael.
Coming up, why ethics in business matter when Viewpoints returns.
Today, about two-thirds of the more than 13 million people diagnosed with type 2 diabetes have blood sugar averages that are out of control. And a significant contributor is high blood sugar levels after meals. A new blood sugar meter, the OneTouch Ultra 2 system, is designed to help patients see the impact of their food and portion choices. Dr. Daniel Lorber of Cornell University Medical College.
While testing and controlling blood sugar levels before meals has always been an important part of our recommendation for people with diabetes, testing after meals on some occasions is also extremely important, particularly in today's supersized culture with the large portions we're dealing with. High sugar levels after meals are more important in determining the risk of heart disease than are high levels before meals.
The OneTouch Ultra 2 system allows users to label specific results with a before or after meal flag. It can also help patients spot meal-related blood sugar trends by displaying 30-day averages. With accurate test results in just 5 seconds, the OneTouch Ultra 2 system is now available in pharmacies nationwide.
Last May, top executives Kenneth Lay and Jeffrey Skilling were found guilty on numerous counts of fraud and conspiracy during their tenure running Enron Corporation. Their illegal dealings, along with those of Andy Fastow and others, led to the largest corporate implosion in American history and caused thousands of Enron employees to lose their jobs and their life savings. There's more to the Enron story than the criminal and financial fallout, however. There's also the issue of corporate ethics. Judith Glaser, CEO of Benchmark Communications Incorporated and author of the book The DNA of Leadership, explains what ethics are with regard to the corporation and its people.
Ethics are the rules which are written and unwritten that we establish with each other in order to enable for the larger organization to benefit and for the individual to carry on with great respect and trust for colleagues.
We've all had some type of ethical training in our lives, whether we learned it in grade school, at home, or at church. But is this personal code of conduct the same as that which businesses should adopt?
Absolutely. A big mistake that people make is to think that there's a personal ethics that you do outside of work and a different kind of ethics that you do at work. And they think that work has a different set of rules and guidelines, and that's just false.
That's Dennis Collins, professor of business at Edgewood College in Madison, Wisconsin, and author of the book Behaving Badly, Ethical Lessons from Enron.
There's one ethic that's in general, do unto others as you want done to you, do what's for the greatest good for the greatest number, and that applies in all situations. Otherwise, you become schizophrenic. You do one ethic here, a different ethic somewhere else, and then people can't trust you. So as an individual, you want to be trusted, and the best way to be trusted is to be the same way in all situations that you're involved in.
Collins says Enron's problems began about 10 years before they became public, and even Kenneth Lay was out of the loop on exactly what was happening for 9 years of that time. However, as CEO, Lay was responsible for what happened, and for his part in covering up the fraud.
Now, all executives have a fiduciary responsibility to tell the truth. So Lay needed to find out what the truth of was going on within the company and to share that truth with the public and the investors, and he came up short on that level. But anybody running an organization, for the most part, they don't know the fine details of what's going on. Nonetheless, they're responsible and they're accountable for it. So they need to create mechanisms where they can find out what's really going on behind the scenes.
Glazer says unethical behavior can result in organizations like Enron that are trying new ways of doing business and growing very fast. Movers and shakers who are ambitious the way Skilling and Fastow were forge ahead when the line between what's right and what's unethical is blurred.
We have seen over and over again in organizations that are baking new ideas, schemes, ways to grow business, way to make money, that there starts to be a small inner circle of people who get together to bake these ideas. And many of them are very entrepreneurial in nature. And they start to take the line where ethics and business normally sit in a healthy way. And they push that line out far in order to account for some of these great ideas that they're coming up with. And as many people have heard in the trials, that there were decisions that were made that were gray. They didn't quite see them as being unethical because there wasn't regulation around how to do business in these areas. And the high entrepreneur, high aggressive, high hubris, high greed person takes that as an opportunity to dive right in and create the world that they want to live in.
While an inner circle of executives at Enron knew how the company was manipulating financial information and engaging in questionable energy trading practices, the rank-and-file employee was unaware of any wrongdoing. Glazer says the top brass was sending them the message that everything was good and getting better.
That's what's so interesting. There's an inner circle of people that are working these, and then there's a whole other level of communication that these same leaders have with their organization that sets into place a belief that they are a winning team, that they are creating wealth at a level and speed that nobody else can do, and there's an encouragement for the employees to believe this and to become part of this. We know of some stories where employees actually spent an incredible amount of money during that time. Their bonuses were accelerated. They drove the big fancy cars to work. And people start to live inside of this fantasy world and love it. And it gets encouraged by the leader's stories suggesting that more success will follow.
In fact, Collins says the traders and others who were involved in suspect practices were encouraged to get even more aggressive. He says the money was there to be made and a whole lot of people signed up to become rich.
With Enron, bonuses and promotions were based solely upon meeting numbers and meeting quarterly numbers. If you met quarterly numbers, you got a bonus and you got promoted. So everybody was focused in on meeting these quarterly numbers. Meanwhile, Enron hired the best and the brightest. For many years, Enron was just a traditional oil company. And then in 1990, Skilling came in. And Skilling looked at this very slow-moving company and said, we need new life in this organization. And at that time, Enron had a lot of debt. So Skilling said, let me hire the best and the brightest. And the only way we're going to hire the best and the brightest from the elite schools is by offering them tremendous stock options. If we offer these folks tremendous stock options, the stock price goes up. They'll all become millionaires by the time they're 40.
That's a pretty big carrot to dangle in front of young, ambitious business school graduates. In order to keep them hungry and compliant, Collins says extra pressure to succeed was applied by the crooks themselves.
The other game that went on with these performance evaluations was that the ultimate decision on whether or not the score that you received on the performance evaluations was Jeff Skilling. And then Jeff Skilling gave that duty over to Andy Fastow. So the person who's ultimately responsible for your evaluation is the people that are playing all the financial accounting manipulation games. What happened at Enron was if you did what Andy Fastow wanted you to do, which was to cheat, you got a bonus and you got promoted. If Andy Fastow told you to hide some numbers here and there, and if you said no, you got a very, very low performance evaluation. And Enron was one of those corporations where it's an up-and-out situation. So they evaluated you on a 1 to 5 scale, and a 5 is great. So if you got a 1, you were going to be kicked out of the organization.
The shoot-from-the-hip style that Enron adopted filtered down to these young go-getters who were told to do whatever it takes to make money. The energy crisis in California in 2001 was caused in part by overreaching traders exploiting the state's need for energy. Glazer says attitudes filter from the top down and can cause normally good people to behave in ways they never had before.
It blows up. It blows up so much. We have had the opportunity to work with companies who have, in fact, where a leader was put into jail for one of the largest consumer frauds in the history of the world. and got to work with the leadership who came in after that to try to fix and repair the culture. And it's absolutely amazing how people get excited about winning. It's called a win-at-all-cost mentality. And it usually comes with this type of diva, hubris, bully boss environment where they think that they are just scamming people and that they're never going to get caught. You know, they really, really, truly believe that they're outside of the law when it comes to this type of behavior.
So what do you do to repair that company? Fire everyone and start over?
The new CEO came in and we were hired to work with him to try to create a whole new culture, a reinvention, if you will, of the culture, which we have done quite a few times with companies. The past CEO went to jail. They also identified the four or five other people who he was working directly with to make this consumer scam happen, and they were all fired from the company. And then the new leader and I and a group of consultants worked to help create meetings. Every 6 weeks, we had the top 31 people from, this was a global company, from around the globe, come together in meetings they had never met before this way to talk openly and honestly about the future of their company, about behaviors, about values, about vision, and how to reset the whole thinking inside the organization to begin to build and rebuild trust that they could work together and achieve goals. It was a startling thing for this company because they had never worked this way. The CEO was the one who made the decisions, and actually everybody had to follow, where this new world that we were trying to create got people engaged to bring their best wisdom and thinking into the meetings and to really strategize how to change the business.
Glazer says that punishing the people involved is important because it sends a signal that unethical behavior will not be tolerated.
Unfortunately, Enron made us believe that you have to have the world crushing down on you and you have to have people go to jail to make that type of radical shift. And sometimes, in fact, the case is in the company that I saw, that's what has to happen. There has to be symbolic acts, whether they're brought on by the government or whether they're brought in by a new leadership team, a new regime who comes in and absolutely starts to what they call hench people or hang them publicly for the values that they hold. I know that Jack Welch did that when he created the Welch Grid, where he said, I have another new matrix to present to you, my world of leaders, which is that it's not just the money that you make, but it's the values that you bring into the organization. And he had all of his people assessed from the top down on those two dimensions.
Collins says that changing the culture from the inside before an Enron-like situation takes hold isn't easy, especially when the leaders are all in on the game and fighting to keep the status quo.
As a business ethics professor, we address this issue in almost every class that I teach. How do you handle an unethical bully who has more power than you have? And one of the mechanisms of handling the unethical bully is you need to find an honest person that you can trust that has the respect of somebody higher up in the organization. And you need to go around the unethical bully and share that information with somebody above the unethical bully and let that person confront the person who's manipulating all of the games. Otherwise, if you just let the unethical bully like Andy Fastow loose, they dominate the entire culture. It came up into this aggressive, nasty survival of the fittest culture, and it went the wrong way.
He says the company code of ethics needs to be simply put and communicated to all employees. It also needs to be followed by everyone, no matter how tight the situation. Enron had a code, and it was displayed where everyone could see it. However, Collins says the problems at Enron were a result of making exceptions to the rules.
In the very, very tight situations when it became, should we play accounting games to make revenue numbers at the quarter or obey the code of ethics? The code of ethics was violated. So the code of ethics was kind of followed in all the easy areas. But in the real difficult areas, when you really need to follow the code of ethics, they ignored the code of ethics. And at one point with Andy Fastow, that ignoring the code of ethics was very, very blatant, where they said, in this particular situation, Fastow is allowed to have a conflict of interest in violation of the code of ethics. And they did that because that was the only way that they could have made the quarterly numbers that they thought they had to meet for Wall Street. And that's all wrong. It's at that point when you have to say, no, the code of ethics says we can't do this. We have to find some other way than to cheat in order to get this goal.
Finally, Glazer says it's time that business schools get their priorities straight when it comes to educating the corporate leaders of tomorrow.
I just read an article that talks about how business schools, unfortunately, are teaching people not to be ethical. In other words, business schools that force the whole concept of winning is and competition is about the only thing that you need to focus on obliterates people's understanding or recollection of the importance of managing the people ethics side. And there's a big movement, and I know I'm part of that because I've been asked to come into many of the business schools recently to talk about my work. In order for people to understand the importance of placing ethics inside of our educational system so that leaders can, in fact, come out in the next generation much stronger and bolder and tougher on these very important issues.
You can learn more about the responsibilities of executives and the role of ethics in business in Judith Glaser's book, The DNA of Leadership. For an understanding of the decision-by-decision process that led to the downfall of Enron, pick up Dennis Collins' book, Behaving Badly, Ethical Lessons from Enron. Both books are available at bookstores and online. Our show is written and produced by Pat Reuter and Stefan Schumacher. Our production director is Sean Waldron. I'm Sandy Houseman.
Viewpoints returns in just a moment.
Great business leaders expect themselves to continually become smarter, faster, and better. But to really fulfill that promise, it requires breaking through what nationally renowned executive coach Carlin Sloan calls the paradox of leadership.
Today, smarter doesn't mean knowing it all. It means asking the right questions and knowing how to manage information. Faster actually means slowing down and taking the time to see the big picture, being relaxed enough to innovate. And better no longer means better than something or someone else. It's not about your competition. It's about being better with the market, with your team members and customers, and ultimately with the external world.
Great leaders learn it's not about me, it's about we. Carlin Sloan's new paradigm is being embraced by leaders at some of the nation's best-known brands, like Allstate, Rodale, and the Wharton School. And it forms the center of Carlin Sloan's new book, Smarter, Faster, Better: Strategies for Effective, Enduring, and Fulfilled Leadership. Smarter, Faster, Better is available on Amazon.com and at bookstores now.
Homeowners, if you want to spend less on bills, how about reducing your mortgage payment up to 33%? It's easy with Quicken Loans. Just write down this number, 800-321-0500. Quicken Loans can show you how to cut your mortgage payment up to 33% so you can make your money work harder, like paying off high-interest credit card bills, affording home improvements, or increasing your retirement savings. Just call 800-321-0500. With over 150 exclusive loan programs, the mortgage experts at Quicken Loans have something for you. This could be the most valuable call you'll make all year. Find out how you can cut your monthly mortgage payment up to 33%. Call Quicken Loans right now at 800-321-0500. 800-321-0500. Quicken Loans, America's home loan experts. Equal housing lender, licensed in all 50 states. Call now, 800-321-0500.
And that's Viewpoints for this week. Viewpoints is produced by MediaTrax Communications. If you'd like a copy of this week's program, call area code 847-299-9500 or on the internet visit viewpointsonline.net. Join us again next week for your public affairs magazine, Viewpoints.